This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on constructive dismissal. I am joined by senior barrister Kolare Sonaike from 1 Essex Court Chambers in London. Kola is described as being very thorough and detailed in his work, a first-class communicator and negotiator, and someone bringing the best results for his clients. He specialises in employment law, covering unfair and wrongful dismissal, discrimination, whistleblowing, compromise and settlement agreements, redundancy, and much more. Kola, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Hattie, thank you so much for having me. This is actually the first legal podcast that I've actually done, so pretty cool to be here.
It's amazing to have you here, Kola. And I was just saying to you, wasn't I, that hopefully we can expand on our work together and look to doing some lives so that we can tap into your extensive amount of knowledge through that form as well. But today we're here to discuss constructive dismissal. And there's some actually really interesting figures on employment law and employment tribunal statistics. In October 2020, the Ministry of Justice published its quarterly update on employment tribunal statistics, revealing an 18% increase in single claims during the lockdown. The firm Ellis Whittam reports that employment tribunal claims are up 26% year on year. That's a lot. Let's start by explaining to our listeners, what do we mean by constructive dismissal, Kola?
Yes, so obviously there's a lot of, you know, technical stuff that I could say about it, but essentially it's a forced resignation. That's pretty much what it comes down to. It is being treated in a way that is so objectionable, treated by your employer in a way that is so objectionable that you feel that you have no option but to resign. So forced resignation, it's just circumstances in your work have just become unbearable. And so you decide, that's it, I'm going away, I'm stepping away. And then you pursue a claim based on that. So that's all the constructive dismissal really is.
Yes. So it's a forced, you know, it's you're forced into resigning yourself as a result of the behaviours of your employer and maybe the circumstances of your employment. And we go to mention different types of things there. And just to quickly say the difference, because I get asked this often, between constructive dismissal and unfair dismissal. Unfair dismissal is when your employer actually ends your employment, isn't it?
So it's a slightly different issue, actually. So unfair dismissal is just saying, I was dismissed, however that came about, and the way that happened was unfair. That's a specific legal term. So there's certain categories you have to satisfy to prove that it was unfair, to amount to unfair dismissal. Constructive dismissal is just a type of dismissal that is when I was forced to resign as opposed to my employer did it.
Yes, yes.
But unfair dismissal applies both to straightforward dismissal and constructive dismissal.
Yes, of course it does.
The real term is unfair constructive dismissal if you kind of want to really go into it.
Yes, because, you know, when we started looking at constructive dismissal and understanding that, you know, you're forced to leave due to the circumstances, and then you look at unfair dismissal, then you're thinking, well, they both sound the same thing. But the way you put it explains it really, really well, in the sense that unfair dismissal is part of constructive dismissal. It can come under that umbrella, but in its separated term, unfair dismissal is when an employer ends your employment in a way that was unlawful. And then obviously the beautiful million segments of law come into what and how and why, and then everybody can get their teeth into that. Let's talk about the actions by an employer that can be classed as constructive dismissal, Kola, please.
Yes. Yeah, so essentially what you're looking at is what has the employer done that in some way is so objectionable that I felt that I had to resign. And that is a range of things. So what you're looking for is what is termed a fundamental breach of your contract. But that can be a range of things. So for instance, if they don't pay you, right, or they pay you less than contractually you're entitled to, pay is one of the staple fundamentals of employment, so that if your employer breaches that term by not paying you, by paying you less than you're owed, by paying you late in circumstances where really they had no good reason or excuse to do it, that's the kind of thing that typically tribunals will say, yes, if you're resigned in response to that, that's a forced resignation, that's constructive dismissal.
Because obviously that behaviour is forcing you to say, look, I can't be in this position anymore. Exactly. I can't work in here. I have to leave. That's a form of constructive dismissal.
Yeah. But beyond that, there are many, many more. So being demoted unfairly, and probably the big catch-all one is what's called a breach of the implied term of trust and confidence. And what that basically says is your employer has a duty to treat you fairly, or at least to not treat you unreasonably. That's a bit loose term, but put it in those terms. And that allows you to basically look at anything and everything. And if you can put it into the category of that is just grossly unfair, that's highly unreasonable, I shouldn't be expected to take that, then you can say that's a breach of the implied term of trust and confidence, and I've resigned because of it. That's a constructive dismissal. So, you know, not dealing with your grievances properly, being discriminating against you for various reasons that are, you know, unfair, things like that.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the points that I also came across was when an employer starts making unreasonable changes to your working patterns or your working agreement without discussing and agreeing them with you. It happens often. I mean, I'm not saying that all employers take those actions whilst they're aware they're doing it, i.e. they're so busy trying to maybe keep their ship afloat, you know, to especially during a pandemic where everybody's firefighting, and some, you know, perhaps aren't doing it knowing that they're changing these T's and C's, knowing that they're giving you more or putting more responsibility on you without considering the effects on you, without discussing it with you, so making changes to your employment terms without them being agreeable. I mean, that's another form of constructive dismissal if those things make you think, well, again, I can't work here anymore, you know?
Yeah. And so things like that is very much about a balance, right? So often employers feel, oh, everything's stacked against us, I can't do anything. Actually, no, it isn't. It's really about what's reasonable. So if your contract says my employer can make certain changes, then it's not unreasonable for an employer to say, hey, listen, I need to do this. Although they should discuss them with you and say, by the way, this is coming up, do you have anything to say? So kind of a golden rule is just don't be unreasonable. Right. I would normally swear when I do this, but I'm not going to do that. Right. Just don't.
No, don't swear, Collar.
Yeah. Don't be unreasonable. Right? Yeah. I use different words sometimes. That's kind of the guiding principle, really, for all of employment law. Just don't be unreasonable. And usually that gives you the answer. Should I make that change? Well, what are the circumstances? How should I do it? And if you do it in an unreasonable way, then your employee can often say, I really can't tolerate this. If you don't change it, I'm off. And then they're off. And then they have a constructive dismissal claim.
And I think there's two takeaways there, Collar. You know, as you're speaking, I'm sort of, my mind's, you know, ticking away. And I'm thinking, well, if your employee comes to you and says, look, that was unreasonable, or you can see that they're unhappy. You know, most employers get to know or should know their employees either through management tiers or directly if it's a small employer. If you see your employees unhappy, if you see there's a problem, address it. Don't let it escalate. Don't ignore it, because it's so easy to bury your head in the sand. And I know it's not so easy to talk about problems, because, you know, it just isn't. Humankind just don't like sitting there and saying, there's a problem here. Let's try and calmly and collectively resolve this without any emotions running high and people running into different directions and doing different things. So I would say communicate and speak about it in any way, which way you know. And even if it means, look, I can't quite bring myself to say to my member of staff, what's wrong? I don't know what's wrong, but there clearly is something wrong. Send a text, send an email on something just to say, look, is there something wrong? Is there something we need to speak about? I think addressing things like that early on can really avoid issues like constructive dismissal and heated and tense emotions and all that sort of thing. Great.
Yeah, I mean, so that is really good practice, and that's what every employer should aim for. Important though for both employers and employees to know though, but that's, there's quite a gulf between good practice and breach of the implied term and trust and confidence that entitles someone to resign and claim constructive dismissal. So as much as it's important to do good and to not be unreasonable, it doesn't mean that every instance of being unreasonable is an automatic constructive dismissal scenario. So it's really about being so unreasonable in a way that no reasonable employer should behave, that you would then say that's the kind of thing that's constructive dismissal.
Yes, and that's again another really key point, I think, Kola, because I think intention as well is considered to some degree. I mean, it doesn't differentiate if somebody has been treated unfairly, but if the intention was genuinely not to go down that road and the employer did everything they could to safeguard their employee from, you know, any grievances, but it can still happen. It doesn't say it didn't. It doesn't mean it, you know, it will be discounted even if we employ tried everything, but it didn't quite work out. Because we're talking about across the board and across the professions here. So, you know, every profession has a different way of handling its conduct and staff and the processes and systems and structures that exist and so on and so on. So let's talk about how hard constructive dismissal can be to prove. What would you say would be the key evidence? And I know this could be a difficult question to answer because, again, we're talking across the professions. But in a nutshell, and trying to pinpoint some key factors that you think would be key in trying to prove it.
Yeah, so I think you probably have to think about slightly different proof for different categories. So some of the kind of really fundamental ones, like pay, right, which is a kind of a big one. If your claim is, hey, I wasn't paid what I should have been, really the proof you need is just, well, what's the pay you should have got? And what did you actually get? And was there any decent reason why you didn't get what you should have done or when you should have got it? So those kind of big ticket items, the proof is relatively straightforward. It's just the facts that usually are not in dispute. The other one, which are actually the more common instances of constructive dismissal, which relate to that broad category of the breach of the implied term of trust and confidence. The evidence you need, so if you're an employee making that claim, for instance, you want to think about what happened, when did it happen, who did it, and how did it make me feel? Those are kind of the four buckets or categories of things to really think about. And I always advise, for instance, employees, if you start to feel this is what, you know, this is how I'm feeling, where it's headed, keep a diary. Yeah, keep it at home. Get at home, write your thoughts. Because I'll tell you this, in court, the best evidence is the one that is most contemporaneous, right? Even if it's slightly inaccurate, because it happened at the time, the judges will often think, okay, that has the most ring of truth about it, as opposed to 2 years later, somebody trying to do their best to remember. So keep a diary note of what's happening, what's going on. Keep emails, you know, things like that. Emails are a treasure trove of evidence.
Wouldn't you say Facebook posts are as well? I mean, we had a case where the claimant, and we were acting on behalf of the employer, was kept posting ridiculous things on Facebook because she was in effect almost framing her employer, but she was talking about the framing that she was doing on Facebook. Ha ha ha, look what this is going. And she exposed herself on Facebook so much, and obviously Facebook is a public platform. If your profile is public, then everybody can see what you're doing and how you're doing, and I have to say, they didn't help her out much in that case.
Yeah. So social media is dangerous.
Dangerous, Kola. You have to highlight that and put it in bold. It is so dangerous.
It definitely is. But actually, in terms of where you get the most critical information to a legal case, email by far outstrips it. Because email is... you send it and you forget that you've sent it. You can be unguarded. you know, as well as the business of whatever the email is work related, there's always the separate comments. Oh, how are you doing? Oh, did you see what so-and-so did? Oh my goodness. How did you feel? I saw your face in the
You've
meeting.
Seen a few of those all emails, of Connor, haven't you? You've scoured those emails. I can see you've got a good memory of quite a few, let's just say.
Yeah. So as an employer, when you're defending a case, review your emails and just make sure that the things that your employees have said or your directors or whatever have said, you are happy with to go to court and defend that. Because really a lot of unguarded comments are made in email. And so that's kind of one of the key pieces of evidence that I always have a look at.
Yes, the first thing Collar will say is, give me the emails. Yeah. No, well, look, I mean, that's really actually... such good advice, because we are quite free and fancy foot and loose on emails, aren't we? And I totally agree with you that they are very powerful, because they are direct forms of communication. When you send an email, you send it directly to a person or persons. So there's no getting away with, well, that wasn't meant for them, or I didn't mean it so that it came about to that person or had that effect. You're saying it directly to a person. So no wonder they're so powerful. But goodness, social media, I have to say, and I know we've said it's dangerous and things like that, but I have seen more social media posts in bundles, in court bundles, I think in the last 5 years than ever in my life. Because, you know, and you're talking from group messages on WhatsApp to the Facebook stuff, that, you know, that kind of stuff that people do on Facebook, let alone you've got the Instagram, the Twitter, and you've got so much more that I'm completely not, you know, probably up to speed with as much as I could be. But one of the things is that I think there's no doubt that since the Supreme Court's decision to scrap employment tribunal fees back in 2017, it's boosted the volume of cases through the employment tribunals and made this area of law so much more accessible to people wishing to make employment claims. Do you think that would you say that the value of employment claims, and I'm talking about the quality of claims, Collar, would you say that in your experience, the quality of claims has gone up because more people can, you know, issue a claim without having to have the money to do so? Or would you say actually the quality of the claims that are probably about the same? It's just the number of claims obviously have shut up. And the statistics earlier was that it's going up 26% year on year.
The numbers have certainly gone up. A big part of that is also they were kind of devastated by the introduction of the fees kind of regime, which the Supreme Court thankfully and rightfully struck down because it was ill-conceived from the start. The interesting thing is, when the fees did come in, the cases that actually still went through were basically, sorry to say, the nutters. And by that I mean the people who were just going to pursue their claim
no matter what.
You know, so they were the ones who were just willing to do it. And you would get claims that were just completely kind of like, this is
bonkers,
crazy. But they would go for it. The people who had legitimate claims, so they're reasonable people who had had something bad happen to them, but are so reasonable, they're like, I can't afford to spend a grand for the privilege of going
just
to
issue.
They stopped pursuing it. So with the abolition of the fees again, that has meant that people who have a legitimate grievance, they may be right or wrong in law, right? But they have a legitimate grievance.
That's a very interesting point that you've just made there, Collar, because having a legitimate grievance can be completely different to being right or wrong in the eyes of the law. That's a podcast in itself, you know.
yeah. Well, look, so there's legitimate grievance, but is that a legal claim? Then even if it's a legal claim, do you have the evidence to back it up, even though you're right? Yeah, so there's all sorts of things that play in. So I think that, there has been an increase. I have not seen, it certainly hasn't come to me as an increase in meritless claims. It seems to just be more people because there aren't fees, and which is right? Usually you've just lost your job.
Yes.
Or even if you haven't, you're generally an employee against an employer. So there is an imbalance in that regard. And you can have a claim frustrated by the cost if you kind of do it. And you still have to pay your own legal fees, right? So it's not cost-free entirely. So I think the increase is generally good for society in that it is better that things get kind of resolved and litigated, and then whoever's right or wrong comes out as a kind of a good way of society managing itself from a workplace point of view.
Well, it's litigation at the end of the day. And as you said, there are certainly many no win, no fee solicitors out there that do employment claims. If you're inclined to get legal help from what I always call the top of the food chain as the bar, there's Direct Access. You do Direct Access, don't you, Collar?
Yeah, yeah,
yes, so Collar does Direct Access at 1 Essex Court. And that I always, always will promote Direct Access over any no win, no fee, any day of any week of any year, period. That's yeah. That's my personal thoughts there delivered. But yes, it's litigation. And a wise person once told me that in litigation that goes on for a very long time, one of two things happen. You know, when lots and lots of money are going in, one party wouldn't necessarily try and wait for the other party to run out of money so they can't fund their claim anymore, or just wait for them to die. That's how many years it can go on for.
Yep.
So, you know, you certainly don't want to ever be in that position. Okay, let's talk about how quickly would somebody need to resign? Is there a time period for that in order to claim constructive dismissal?
Yeah, so officially there is no time limit, in that the mechanics of a constructive dismissal is my employer has behaved in a way that is a fundamental breach of my contract in the different ways we talked about, and I have resigned in response to that conduct. And so what the court is looking at is, can we say that that person really has resigned in response to that conduct? Or have they acted in a way that must be taken to be a waiver of the breach that they could have complained of?
And that's what I was just going to ask. Yeah. Could somebody be criticised to say, well, you put up with it for a year, you put up with it for X amount of months?
Yeah. So that's the thing, is if somebody has left it so long and still kind of continue showing up and acting that things are fine, it can be in some circumstances said, well, you've affirmed their breach, or you've waived the breach by your conduct by tolerating it for so long. However, there are various caveats to that. So for instance, a lot of things are ongoing breaches. So a lot of implied term and trust and confidence breaches are, you're making my life circumstance just unbearable. That tends to not be a one-off instance. It tends to be a situation that's just going on. And so there's a lot of accommodation for employees to say, I'm trying to take this. Hey, I can't just leave my job, so I'm tolerating this, but it's really terrible until I get to the point that I can't tolerate it anymore. Kind of called the last straw doctrine, like something just flips me over the edge and that's it. But it went on for years. So you can still actually, there can be a long period of time between when it starts and when you resign. The issue is there a gap between when it stops and when you resigned? And that's where it is. So, you know, if you start going beyond 3 months from something happening, or with an incident or an issue stopping, and you haven't resigned, you're going to have the question of, did you waive the breach or did you wait too long? But that's not certain. Sometimes it can be shorter than that. Sometimes they will allow people to say, look, I had to stomach it whilst I was looking for another job.
I was just going to say, you know, life circumstances as well, Collar. You know, we're hopefully coming out of a pandemic. That's where the next quarter of life hopefully is bringing us. But, you know, some people they can't afford not to be in that job. And if there's no other jobs available and you cannot afford to be without the income and you have to stick it out, surely those kind of mitigating circumstances will be considered by a court, and if they can prove, look, here's the evidence that I was looking elsewhere, here's my applications that I was making, here's telephone calls that I was making, I just couldn't get a job elsewhere, surely the court, you know, has to bear some, or the tribunal has to bear some thought.
They specifically will, especially if you can show the things that you were doing, because what it says is, okay, this is your state of mind, you were in your mind feeling that this was unbearable and you had to leave. The mechanics of your leaving were just being practical. I can't just leave my job and not get paid.
Yeah.
So it's really about looking at what's the degree of gap between the end of the treatment and the act of actually resigning. So no strict time limit, but basically do it reasonably quickly so that that issue just doesn't come up.
As soon as you can. And I think one of the crucial points we should mention here is time limitation from bringing a claim to a tribunal. So from 3 days, 3 months less a day, you have got 3 months less a day to bring a claim to the tribunal from the date of the last incident.
Yes, although that can be extended by use of what's called the ACAS conciliation process, where if you put in a claim, notify ACAS that you have this issue, then time is extended for a certain period until ACAS says, okay, we've looked at it, we can't help you resolve it, so go ahead with your claim. So there's a little bit of kind of extended time because of that. But essentially be thinking 3 months from the date that I resign or the end of my employment, I have 3 months to, or 3 months less a day, to bring the claim for that.
Yes, and ACAS, I mean, there's a wealth of free information and assistance on ACAS, the Advisory Conciliation and Arbitration Service, which is a publicly funded independent organisation giving free, impartial advice to both employees and employers on workplace rights, rules and best practice. Go to their website at acas.org.uk and as I said, it's both for employees and employers and it's free. It's definitely worth taking a look and taking a read on there. Collar, that's all we've got time for.
Hey, thank you for having me. This is fun.
Time flies when you're having fun, right?
Yeah.
We're definitely going to be doing this again. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
No, appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Hattie.
And I'll say to our listeners, don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcast. And you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.